This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Actor B.D. Wong first became known for his starring role in the Broadway show M. Butterfly, for which he won a Tony Award. He's appeared in several films, including the Father of the Bride movies, in which he played Martin Short's assistant. On Law & Order, SVU, he's the forensic psychiatrist, and in the HBO prison series Oz, he played prison chaplain Father Ray Mukata. Here he is in a scene from the first season of Oz, meeting one of the prisoners, Alvarez, for the first time.
Go! Go! Get up! Get
up! Miguel Alvarez. I'm Father Ray Mukata. I'm one of the prison chaplains. According to this file, you're about to be a father. You've got a girlfriend, Maritza. She's an inmate at Parker Women's.
Yeah, we got arrested together. Ain't that sweet?
I can arrange for you to be there for the birth.
I don't give a shit about shit like that.
Miguel, you'll probably be paroled in 2 years. When you get out, you'll want to be a father to your kid.
Is that right? Mira ese pendejo ahí. Man, that's my father. You know, and up in some cell block somewhere is my grandfather, man. So don't be giving me none of your shit.
I get it. You had a miserable childhood. Tough. But let me tell you something. You're still responsible for bringing a new life into this world. You are responsible. The same way that I'm responsible for you, for your soul. So get ready, Miguel Alvarez, because I'm going to be over your shoulder. Comprende? Mi amigo.
B.D. Wong in a scene from Oz. Wong's new memoir is about a part of his life that was not public. He and his longtime partner, Richie Jackson, who is also Wong's agent, decided they wanted to have a child through a surrogate mother. Wong donated the sperm. The egg was donated by Jackson's sister. The surrogate mother was carrying twins, and they were born prematurely. One didn't make it. The survivor, Jackson Fu Wong, is 3 years old. The story of his birth and the difficulty he had surviving the disorder that killed his twin brother is the subject of B.D. Wong's new memoir, Following Fu. Why did you and your partner decide you wanted to have a baby?
I think that the desire to become a parent is, you know, is a natural human, boundary-free thing that happens to you after a certain amount of time in your life. And it just seemed like a very natural thing to desire in your life. I find it kind of actually an odd question. Why? Because I don't think we ask all people that. I don't know. Is there something unique about our being gay that makes it quite more curious? Is that kind of the angle of the question?
Well, I, for instance, have decided not to have children, and a lot of people I know do not have children. So,
well, yes, that's certainly true.
When you have to go through so much effort to have a child, it's not happening by accident. It's like,
well taken.
You not only know you want to have a child, you're filling out forms, you're hiring a surrogate, you're going through a lot of work. Some people kind of casually want to have children. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't, or it accidentally happens, or whatever. This is a very decisive move.
You're absolutely right, and you know I'm very naive about the fact that I think everybody wants to have kids. You're absolutely right. I felt very strongly about having kids. Now, why, I'm not sure. I do want to have a relationship with my son that is something that grows and enriches my life and both of our lives mutually as the years go on, and I find that one of the, personally for me, one of the potentially most rewarding things that you can experience. And I believe that Richie feels the same way. So together we had always wanted to do that. And it was just a matter of time before it happened. And it was just a matter of time before I realized that it wasn't going to happen naturally and that we had to kind of go through a lot of, jump through a lot of hoops to see how we could make it happen.
Now, you decided to do this through a surrogate mother as opposed to, you know, adopting.
Yes.
Why did you want to take that route? I mean, I know a lot of people who have adopted and have gone to, like, China or Vietnam to adopt a baby. In some ways, I guess that's easier. In some ways, maybe harder. I don't know. Why did you decide the surrogate route?
We were interested in the idea of having a genetic bond with our baby, both of us. You know, Richie's sister, Sue, donated her eggs, and I fathered the embryos, and it was just something that was the first thing we looked into, if you can imagine. We decided we wanted to be parents, and then we were acquainted with this organization, an agency in Los Angeles that matches gay couples with surrogates. And we thought, well, let's look into this and see whether or not it's something we can do. It turned out in our family that, you know, not a lot of gay couples has this, have this particular relationship with a sister who's the right age, who's willing to donate her eggs. And we had that. So we thought, well, let's see if it works. You know, it's something that doesn't really work that dependably, you know, because of the in vitro and all of the technology involved. So we were just looking into it, and we said, you know, if this fails, then we'll just, there'll be tons of other ways to do it. We just wanted to see if we could do it this way first.
Shauna, the surrogate mother, went into labor after 28 weeks, which is 7 months, and you took her to the hospital. What were the problems that the babies were having? And these were twins.
They were identical twin boys, and they, unbeknownst to us, they were suffering from a condition called twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, where one twin gives all of his blood and through their shared vascular network to the other. So one of them becomes overloaded with blood, and the other one becomes quite anemic. And that was the main reason for their distress and for their announcing their arrival quite so early.
So one of the twins died shortly after birth.
That's right.
And was the other's life in jeopardy?
The other's life was in jeopardy for 3 months after that point, during which time we stayed in intensive care, and we flew him to San Francisco from Modesto, where he was born. And he stayed in a world-class teaching hospital, an intensive care nursery at University of California, San Francisco. And yes, he was indeed in jeopardy almost that entire time.
How did the death of your son, Boaz, affect your feelings about your surviving son, Jackson?
I really believe that Boaz gave his life to Jackson. I think that they were both in a fair amount of distress at the time of their birth. And I really believe that, as one doctor put it, they demanded to be born because they knew that they were in terrible danger of both not making it. I have always looked at Boaz in a very heroic way and see him as someone who made a sacrifice, knowing that if they stayed in utero much longer, they both would not have made it. So I think they both kind of said, they did whatever they could. And, I mean, certainly they had tried to be born a week earlier, and the doctor stopped it with any number of medications. But the second time, there was nothing that could be done to stop them. They came fast and furious, and I believe that not only Boaz gave an incredible gift to his brother, but that his brother always has that gift with him, and it really informs his survival sensibility that he seems to have, and the fact that he was able to make it through that crazy 3 months, I believe, is also a gift that is from, you know, kind of an angel's presence in his life.
Can you describe how Jackson looked when he was born prematurely?
Well, I laugh because, you know, the name of the book is Following Foo, The Electronic Adventures of the Chestnut Man, and everybody wants to know why he was called the Chestnut Man. And really, the only reason is because somebody asked me, what does he look like? And I said, well, he looks like a chestnut man. And I meant those old guys in the corner in New York who were selling chestnuts in the winter at Christmas time, and they're just kind of huddled over the coals and trying to make it, you know, and very, very kind of wizened and old. And you know how they say that you don't look again like you were when you were a baby until you're very, very old. So he did resemble a very, very old man, you know, a tiny, tiny, less than 3 pound old man. And he did look very, very frail, and he was very small, Terry. He was 2 pounds, 13 ounces. And you know, by the time that I saw him, he was hooked up to all of those traditional premature infant kind of apparatus. And yet at the same time, he had a resilience. He was very, very unresistant to all of the poking and prodding that he endured that entire time. And I found that actually kind of inspiring.
He had to have a lot of medical procedures, including intestinal surgery.
Yes, he did.
Which is, you know, it's pretty difficult for anybody, but you're looking at this like 2 pound baby having it.
Yeah. At 2 weeks of age, you know.
Yeah, so was it difficult to deal with all of the helplessness? I mean, here you have this, like, helpless 2 pound, some ounce baby. getting, you know, intestinal surgery, and you're the worried father, and it's not like you can talk to your baby and tell it not to worry. First of all, that would be false, and second of all, you know, it's just a baby. I mean, you're helpless, he's helpless. I guess my question is dealing with so much helplessness.
Yeah. Well, that is a huge part of what I wrote about during this time. I wrote these emails to all of our friends and family, reaching out to them and telling them, you know, how things were going, because every day there were all of these kind of medical twists and turns, which is very, very traditional for a premature infant. And the helplessness is really kind of the main source of, in some ways, the ironic hilariousness of it, if you can imagine. I know that sounds really strange, but here I was in this impossible situation, you know, tearing my hair out and crying and doing all of these things. And I did feel incredibly helpless. And his helplessness was less of an issue for me. I mean, I was just happy that he was there in this incredibly wonderful place with these incredible, incredibly gifted and committed people to take care of him. And so I felt less helpless about that, and I also felt like his helplessness was kind of taken care of by their expertise and knowledge, you know.
How's your son Jackson's health now? He's what, about three?
He just turned three, yeah, last Tuesday, as a matter of fact, and he's very well, and I appreciate your asking. He is obviously, as you can imagine, a great joy for us, and we are very grateful for him. We don't know really necessarily, or we haven't been shown what, if any, challenges he may have in the future, but he really seems great now.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor B.D. Wong. His new memoir about his son is called Following Fu. This book is, in a way, you're coming out, your official coming out to...
Officially, yeah.
Right. Yeah, you've been acting for years. Why was this the occasion, and why wait until now?
Well, the answer to the second part of the question, why wait until now, has a lot to do with the fear of never working. You know, when you're an actor, can be a very... actors have a kind of comic reputation for being self-involved and neurotic. And there are real reasons for any actor who actually is self-involved and neurotic. First of all, the craft of acting requires you to use your essence, your soul, in the work. It's not like any other craft in the world. I mean, even a musician plays an instrument which is not him. For me, coming out was put at bay because of my own neuroses about, you know, the opportunities that were all already very slim for me when I entered the field as an Asian American. And I held it very highly, the kind of practical consideration of, wow, gee, if you came out, that would really be like cutting your arm off in some ways, wouldn't it? And I think over the years I've discovered that the answer is no, it wouldn't necessarily. I think it's up to me to, in some ways, create my own career. And so the book kind of told me that this was exactly the right time to share myself fully with everyone, with the world, and with myself in some ways. And that was really an important kind of turning point for me.
Now, you were concerned that coming out might have an adverse effect on your career. I think it's interesting, at the Tony Awards on Sunday, it just seemed to be kind of dominated by gay-themed shows and gay actors. The songwriters who won for Hairspray declared their love and kissed. Harvey Fierstein won, and of course he performs in drag in Hairspray. I should mention he's represented by your partner Richie. She's his agent.
Yes.
The director and star of Take Me Out, which is about a gay baseball player, won Tony's. Do you think that that's a sign that, well, things are really changing?
It is kind of a sign. I mean, it is you know, Broadway and the theater are a very special place, and they are, you know, in some ways, Broadway and the theater are a home for a lot of show business disenfranchised people, including people, ethnic minorities and gay people. So there is a sense of safety that people feel in the theater. Now, the Tony Awards are an example of the commercial theater, and I think what you're saying is on national TV for 3 hours, to have that unabashed kind of and celebratory display of you know, art, not only artistic creative expression, which includes gay themes, but you know, gay artists who are don't feel the need to edit themselves on national TV. I think that is an example or an indication that there is a comfort zone that didn't exist a few years ago, and that is immensely encouraging. I mean, that's the kind of thing that we need as a society to kind of break down some of these barriers.
While your son was born prematurely, and his life was so fragile, just like hanging in the balance, and it was one emergency procedure after another. Uh-huh. You're running back and forth to New York shooting Oz.
Yes.
I mean, for anyone who hasn't seen Oz, I mean, Oz is the HBO series, or was the HBO series, about like the meanest, most sadistic, and most handsome convicts in TV history.
Well, it's the antithesis to kind of stable parental energy, I think.
Yes, you absolutely.
Know, I think that's what you're saying.
That's exactly it.
In some ways, that's of great relief when you're going through something like that. If you can imagine, you know, I was able to get away from the hospital and the stress of that for a moment and see my, you know, great friends who supported me so unflinchingly during this time. And that was only a positive thing. The content of the show is something people are often very, very intrigued by, and even the content of the other show that I'm on, Law and Order Special Victims Unit, there are these kind of really deep and dark kind of themes that are in these two shows, and I don't know why I'm on both of them, but be that as it may, people are often intrigued by what it's like to shoot them, and for me, it's really not at all an entry or a journey into the dark. It's really, I'm able to separate the make-believe aspect of it quite easily, and so it becomes quite fun for me actually to do these shows. And creatively, it was a release for me to be able to work while I was doing all of this. I can't say that I didn't find it interesting and rather ironic and funny that it was this particular show that I was doing, and that I would run back to this very, very different world.
And of course, on Oz, you play the chaplain, so you're always literally trying to do God's work in the
trying,
prison.
Yes.
Trying,
yes.
Well,
I wasn't always
failing,
quite so successful.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
One of the really interesting things about Oz is the audience that it has. On the one hand, it has all these, you know, people who are interested in gangsters, and it has like a big hardcore rap audience, because there's a lot of rap music on the show and you know, guest rap stars and stuff. But it also has a big gay following because, you know, it's this real men's show, and there's a lot of men having sex with men on the show. And you know, and also you have these, like, you know, rappers who make appearances on the show, but you also have these cabaret stars, Rita Moreno, Patti LuPone.
Betty Buckley, right.
Betty Buckley, exactly. And even the actor who plays Vern Schillinger, the neo-Nazi, J.K. Schilling, you know, was one of the stars of Guys and Dolls. So it's just in terms of the population of the show and the population of its audience, it's so intriguing.
It is. I mean, there are a lot of different reasons. You know, New York actors are a very special breed, and the show shoots in the New York area or shot in the New York area. And so Tom Fontana and casting for Oz utilized so many of these wonderful performers, many of whom are Broadway musical performers because they're people from that area. So there was a kind of geographic reason for that, and there was a reason also that Tom has a great love for these performers. I mean, he's not a particular Broadway musical fan, but he really appreciates the work of some of these actors and wrote parts for them and stuff like that. So, it is interesting. It gave the show, I mean, who would think that a show that was so full of such kinds of characters would also be full of people from Broadway musicals? That seems very odd, but it's true. And then and there was actually even an episode that he wrote which was musical and that people sang in.
Oz has certainly boosted your recognition. Has it changed your career? Are you getting offered different kinds of parts than you, or more parts than you were before?
Well, you know, I spent a fair amount of time when I was just starting out in movies doing a lot of really kind of nutty comedy. And so it has been great for me to kind of reconnect to, I don't know, what I would call real acting, what I would call kind of three-dimensional character study and human relationship kind of acting. And this was definitely the one great forum that I have had in the recent past to do that kind of work. And I feel that that has balanced out my persona and allowed people to allow me to do that kind of work more than just the kind of silly comedy stuff.
Your first really big role was M. Butterfly on Broadway. You won a Tony Award for that. And you played a Chinese opera star who passes as a woman but is really a man. And John Lithgow played the American diplomat who falls in love with you thinking that you are a woman and then has to deal with all the subsequent confusion. How did you get the part?
I got the part through, a kind of exhaustive kind of talent search for this kind of extremely unique creature, a man that could physically pass for a woman, who could sing and do, you know, physically handle the Chinese opera, which is a very difficult, you know, theatrical medium, and also could really play, ironically enough, could convincingly play a man in the third act of the play. I was in Los Angeles at the time, kind of doing bit parts on Simon and Simon and, you know, TV shows like that. And I got this call from the agent saying there's a Broadway show that you can get an audition for if you fly yourself to New York. And I said, I didn't have the money to fly to myself to New York, but, you know, send me the script, whatever. You know, I'll look at the script. I've always wanted to do a Broadway play. Is it a good part? And I called my parents right away and said, I need some money to go to New York. I have to go to an audition for this play. This is unbelievable. And this is going to change somebody's life. And I don't really think I could ever get this part, but I really do think that I should try. And it will be a great experience for me to try, and I'll meet some great people. And so they did lend me some money to go to New York, and I went on a, you know, cheapy little airline flight. I flew myself to New York, and I put myself out there. You know, I put myself before them. And they bit. And I, you know, there was a long process of waiting for them to decide and me coming back and meeting the director yet again and all of that stuff. And it was after several months that they actually signed on the dotted line and gave me that part. And it was incredible. It was an incredible experience from that time in my life when I was very idealistic and really wanted to work as an actor very passionately.
What are the odds that the breakthrough role that you get is a role that's written for someone who's both Asian and gay?
Well, and it's not written for a gay. It's not written for a gay person.
No. But I mean, the character is gay.
Yes, and well, that's there. That's a I don't know.
Part
know,
of the whole the world, ambiguity,
the,
right? Yeah.
Yes, I mean the world of the play exists in a very strange kind of a world that cannot necessarily be defined with our own kind of conventional definitions.
But you get the point.
But I totally get the point.
Yeah.
I'm always very, very, as you can tell, I'm very, very protective of the character and all of that stuff. Now that I'm out, I think it can be clear that the reasons why is because I'm not protecting my own reputation or sexuality, but because I really feel that the play works on a level that transcends traditional sexual orientation. However, what were the odds? You know, the odds are, you know, very slim. You know, it was incredible. I knew that when I read the script, I thought, I cannot, holy cow, I'm reading the script and everything that they're asking this person to do, I can do. And I really meant that, you know, actors do that a lot, but I was thinking, wow, this is incredible. I can do these things. I could compete for this part, and I could really compete for it in a big way. I mean, I have this kind of freaky soprano voice that I can sing in. I have this voice that I can, you know, I had a lot of the ingredients, and they were very kind of bizarre ingredients in some ways. I had, you know, a background in musical theater, and I had a sensibility that allowed me to really also, this is the most important thing probably, to get it, to get the part, to understand what the person needed to do and how it should be played and what should, how to kind of get it. Not only just that I could get it, but how to get it. And so that I was lucky. It was a very, very good match for them too, because I was, you know, the right age when it happened. It wasn't like, you know, what happened, I read the script and it was like, oh, it's too late. The script finally came along, or I'm too young or I'm too old, you know. So you're right. It was really interesting that way.
No, it's funny. David Henry Hwang, who wrote M. Butterfly, wrote the book for the revival of Flower Drum Song, which was on Broadway. And the funny thing is, Flower Drum Song was always like the stereotype of the only parts for Asian actors available in America, particularly on Broadway. And it was the part that I think Asian actors looked to avoid. You know, I don't want to do a Flower Drum Song kind of role.
Right. It was the kind of thing. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering if you finish your thought and then I'll tell you what I was thinking.
Well, I was going to say that we've always had a real love-hate relationship with Flower Drum Song. And so in one way, we would turn the TV on and the movie Flower Drum Song on, and we'd be so thrilled that there were Asian people on the TV, and that we were so thrilled that the Chinatown and the Chinese-American community were being depicted. And at the same time, there was a sense of kind of patronization or something that really made us uncomfortable on a certain level. And it was always very hard for me to negotiate these two feelings of thinking, well, there's this thing, there is Flower Drum Song, and yet at the same time, yeah, but Flower Drum Song is still Flower Drum Song and was created by non-Chinese people as a kind of idea of what it means to be Chinese-American. And that is what David really reinvented, was owning the point of view of the show and saying, well, if it's about Chinese Americans, then if, as a Chinese American, this is what I think it's really about to be Chinese American. And he imbued this kind of quaint old show with some very, very modern social values.
One of the TV shows that you were cast in was the Margaret Cho short-lived sitcom All-American Girl.
Yes.
And she talks about that show in her stand-up act, and you know, in her one-woman show, and
brilliantly, yeah.
Yeah. So, did that show strike you as something that was a breakthrough, or that had to be forced to succumb to stereotype?
Well, you know, unfortunately, it was a little bit like the Flower Drum Song of the '90s. It was the show that was so, we were also looking forward to it. I mean, I was looking forward to it as a member of the Asian American community, as just a consumer. And it was the first Asian American family, if you can believe it, on television. In 1995, the first Asian American family on a television sitcom was Margaret Cho. And so we were thrilled by it. And then we got there and we realized, I think, the main thing I think that really happened, to boil it all down, is that they weren't able to properly channel Margaret's unique essence. I mean, she was completely turned into a completely different thing, and it became very false. And that false core resonated throughout the entire show. So the whole show had a kind of falseness to it, and a sense of kind of sitcom-y. The potential was great, and then the show's creation was actually, there was nothing important about it. There was nothing revolutionary or even challenging about it. It just became kind of a generic television sitcom with this incredibly gifted person, a genius, if you will, at its center that was totally not being tapped. And that was really sad to be a part of that. I mean, it was so disillusioning, and certainly it did a number on her, as she talks about in her shows, and on many different levels. And it was really hard.
Now, your parents grew up in Chinatown. What did Chinatown mean to you when you were growing up?
Chinatown was, I had a very, you know, I really appreciate the question. I had a very, very tough time in my childhood, particularly when I decided that I wanted to be an actor, because I blamed my Asian Americanness for being the thing that would keep me from having what I wanted. And so I started to really go through a whole number, did a whole number on myself, not being rather ashamed of being Asian American, being ashamed of being Chinese, and wanting to assimilate as to a point of exaggeration almost, where I tried to really ignore that part of me. So I didn't have a great relationship with Chinatown earlier on in my childhood. I didn't appreciate it. I didn't appreciate what it could represent to me, certainly the way that I do now. And I didn't want to have anything to do with anything Chinese or Asian American. Now, since then, I have gone on an incredible journey of self-acceptance. Sounds really rather lame. It's a kind of self-love, of self-discovery and understanding what it is that makes me me, including being gay. But being Asian American is another facet of who I am, which is terrific. It's beautiful and wonderful and very individual, and not any more individual than anything else, but individual nevertheless. And reaching that conclusion and being able to share that I feel that way with younger people who might feel the way I felt then is very, very empowering to me. And the journey has been really incredible. You know, my parents were great role models as Chinese Americans and just as parents. And I didn't always get it because I was, because of, for a lot of reasons, you know, the media doesn't help us to love ourselves when we're Asian American. It just doesn't. There is not a lot of validation for Asian Americans on television, in the movies, in the magazines, anywhere. And so that causes a lot of problems for young kids. I certainly speak from personal experience. At the time when I grew up, it was a big deal, and it caused feelings of shame that were really, really heavy, and has taken me to, it took me the huge threshold of M. Butterfly to understand how great it could be to be Asian American as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an equation that was very valuable to me and very, very welcome at that time. Here was a Chinese American playwright who wrote this play about a Chinese American guy who has this experience with the Caucasian majority that was validating to me and was able to be put up on the stage and celebrated, and that really changed my life.
Well, B.D. Wong, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
B.D. Wong's new memoir about becoming a father is called Following Fu.